good morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for a half hour each weekday morning, including right now. And you can give me a call if you'd like to at this number. It is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. And I just need to tell my call screener right now that my computer closed down my call screening software, which I'm going to have to reopen. And that means I don't see who's calling. So Patrice or somebody there, if you'd like to let me know in my headphones, that will obviously help me out. In the meantime, I'm going to be taking a question from Travis. Travis is a fellow who has sent me a number of questions over the past weeks, and he's from San Diego. He says, do you know of any reason for the redundancy in the Bible in comparing Leviticus with Deuteronomy and the books of Samuel and Kings with the book of Chronicles? There were times when I felt I was reading almost word for word what was written in previous books. Can you tell me why this redundancy was necessary? Well, I don't really know if I could say why it's necessary. I can tell you why it exists. The reason it exists is because there are a number of different cases in the Bible where different people are telling the same story. And that's, in the days of Samuel, the story of David is told there, and it's also told later on by another author, later on in Chronicles. Now, perhaps we could argue that our Bible could have gotten by with only one story, one record of the same story. And perhaps we could have, although the fact is that even though they are, they do cover lots of the same ground, no question about that, there are different details in the different accounts. So in a sense, we are reading the same story over again sometimes in Chronicles that we've run into in Samuel or in Kings, but it's not going to be word for word the same. Sometimes it is, almost word for word the same, but there will be some details left out of one account that are in another one. Now, you might say, well, I'd just soon not have to read the story twice. Well, you don't have to if you don't want to. But if you're interested in hearing two accounts of the same story, giving different details, then that's why we have that information. Whether it's absolutely necessary to our well-being, spiritually, I don't know. I don't think I would say that it necessarily is. I mean, if the books of Chronicles had not been written and had not covered again those stories, then it's not, I don't think we'd be necessarily spiritually impoverished. But the books of Chronicles do contain a number of stories and a number of details that are not found in the other books, so I'm glad they're there. It's similar to reading the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. You're certainly going to, as you read through them, okay, thank you. You do read the same stories over again in many cases, but they're not all the same. They are different stories in some cases. Sometimes they're worded different. So, there's not really, some people might say, well, I don't want to read this over and over again. Well, okay, then you don't have to, but some of us do enjoy it. Some of us enjoy seeing the different details and so forth, and maybe that's why God included them all. I know that if there were 10 more stories of the life of Christ available written by eyewitnesses, I'd love to read them all, even if there was a lot of overlapping in them. In fact, there are certain people whose biographies I've read like four or five biographies of the same person. George Mueller, for example, I've read at least five biographies of him. Sundar Singh, I've probably read three or four biographies of him. And, of course, there's a lot of repetition of the same stories, but not all the same. So I'm not going to complain if there's two different, stories of the life of David or Solomon or whatever. A person who doesn't want that, doesn't want to read the repetition, I guess they don't have to read the whole Bible if they don't want to, but I think there's benefit in it, and that's just why it's there. Okay, let's talk to John from Lemon Grove, California, and welcome to the Narrow Path, John. Thanks for calling.
Morning, Steve. My question was, I read the wrong thing, it's 310, not 316, bring ye all the tithes in the storehouse.
Uh-huh.
My question is, what is that verse? I know I read your thing on tithing and stuff, but I was wondering what it means in this particular context. I mean, who is he dealing with, and what's the reason?
Yeah, well, Malachi is written to the Jews who had returned from the Babylonian exile, and they had built the temple again and reestablished the temple worship and the priesthood and all that, but they had become disappointed. They expected more glorious things to occur. Some of the things they'd read in the prophets about the return of the exiles from Babylon had made it sound to them like it was going to be a lot more glorious than it was. And they were having trouble, financial troubles and all kinds of things. And so they were kind of losing their zeal for God. So in the book of Malachi, the prophet Malachi was sent by God to sort of stir them up, rebuke them for being so lukewarm. Among the ways their lukewarmness was seen was that they were bringing flawed animals for sacrifices. Instead of bringing the best animals, they were bringing blind and lame animals and sacrificing them to God. They were even divorcing their wives for no good reason, except apparently that they were interested in younger wives, and so they divorced their older wives and married other women, apparently. Another thing they were doing was neglecting to pay the tithes, which were the support of the priests and the Levites in the temple. And so the book of Malachi, which is a short book, actually takes the Jews to task about these areas of neglect in their lives and rebukes them soundly and tells them to get back on track. So Malachi chapter 3 is the portion you're talking about is talking to them about their neglect of paying tithes and tell them to get, you know, bring their tithes back in. So it's not really much different than just telling them to keep the law that they were supposed to keep.
Yeah, but then it talks about this blessing. It says, "I'll pour you out a blessing."
Right. He says he'll bless them if they obey.
If they obey.
Yeah, there's lots of promises like that in the Old Testament, that if the Jews would obey the voice of God, if they would keep his covenant, that he would bless them. In Deuteronomy 28, for example, in the first 14 verses, he says, if you obey me and keep my covenant, you'll be blessed in your farmland, you'll be blessed in your the fruit of your womb, you'll be blessed in the city, you'll be blessed in the field. You'll have all kinds of blessings. And so that Malachi is repeating that, basically, that if you obey God, those blessings will come to you.
Some translations, King James says, bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse. Mm-hmm. Other translations say, bring the whole tithe. What do you suppose is the difference?
I don't think there is a difference.
I would think one would mean everybody bring their tithe, and the other one would bring whatever the whole tithe is.
Bring all your tithes would mean the complete 10%. I mean, a tithe was 10% of their crops, really.
You don't think it means everybody tithing?
Well, I don't think that phrase means that, but it wouldn't be much different if it did. I mean, all the Jews were supposed to tithe. Yeah, everybody was supposed to tithe. So he could have told them all to tithe, but I think that particular phrase means bring the whole tithe, or bring all the tithes.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you very
much. Well, thanks for your call, John. Okay. Mm-hmm. God bless you. Let's talk to Louise from Stockton, California. Louise, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I just want to say that I hope your program stays on the air.
Thank you. I do, too.
Yes. My question is, you know, Jesus said the greatest commandment was to love God with all your strength and mind and heart and so-and-so. I was just wondering if you could elaborate on what does it mean to love God with all your mind? If you could elaborate on that.
Well, when Jesus quoted it that way, love the Lord your God with all your heart, also all your mind and all your strength, I think that's just a way of saying with all that you are, that everything you have is to be committed to God. Your emotions, your thoughts, your energies, that every part of you, every aspect of you is to be devoted to God. And your use of those things should be an expression of your love for God. So in the case of your mind, I would think that it means that you devote your mind to the pursuit of the most God-honoring, God-glorifying pursuits, and also that your thoughts should be such as those that would be thoughts that glorify and love God. That's what I would assume it means. To love God with all that you have, that all that you are, seems to be what's intended by that long list of things, all your heart, your soul, your mind, your strength. And you know, it seems like that's just saying whatever you've got, whatever you are. Let everything about you be devoted to God, and let your entire life and thoughts be for the glory of God.
Mm,
Paul put
okay.
it this way, yeah, in 1 Corinthians 10:30, Paul said, whatever you do, whether you eat or drink, do all to the glory of God. And I think that he also said in Philippians that you should think on such things as are edifying and pure and good and so forth. So, I mean, our minds, I think, should be devoted and cultivated to whatever thoughts and plans would glorify God.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That would be my assumption.
Okay. I was just like, I don't know. I didn't know if that meant that you're supposed to be like 24/7 thinking about God, or. But I think your explanation
well,
is better.
Well, all your thoughts should be governed by an awareness of your devotion to God, I think. It doesn't mean that every thought has to be directly about God. Obviously,
mm-hmm.
you have to balance your checkbook once in a while.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But you should. But you, whatever you do, when you're ordering your finances or writing a letter or an email or having a conversation, governing everything that's going on in your mind should be the foundational awareness of God, of God and of His ownership of you and of His character, of His expectations. I mean, that God, thoughts of God should permeate your whole life, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's reality. You know, A.W. Tozer pointed out that some people think that if you just devote yourself wholly to God, that'll narrow you down to be a very little narrow person. But since
mm-hmm.
God is broader than the whole universe, it's the most broadening thing you can do to your life is to be focused upon God and meditating on God. It'll broaden your life, not narrow.
Oh, I believe so, too. Thank you
so much
for your answer.
All right. Well, thank you, Louise, for your call.
Okay.
God bless you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Okay, our next caller is Teresa from Los Banos. Teresa, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I have a question in regards to the different versions of the Bible. I have a new King James Version, and
mm-hmm.
I just kind of want to find out what's the difference between the different versions.
Well, the New King James Version, the New King James Version and the King James Version have something, of course, in common with each other besides the words King James Version. They both use a certain family of manuscripts on the New Testament, which is called the Textus Receptus. And there are many people who believe that the Textus Receptus group of manuscripts are the ones that are the best manuscripts that we have of the New Testament. And the King James and the New King James used those when they were translating the New Testament. Now, modern translations generally use a different family of manuscripts for the New Testament called the Alexandrian text. And many Christians feel that they are the best and most accurate text of the New Testament available to us in the Greek. And so there's the Textus Receptus, and there's the Alexandrian text. These are two different families of manuscripts, Greek manuscripts of the New Testament. And there's some disagreement among scholars as to which are closer to the original. Now, most scholars today seem to think that the Alexandrian text is more genuine, more close to the original reading. And that's why almost all the new translations, well, all of them do, use the Alexandrian text. But there are still people who believe that the Textus Receptus is better, and therefore they prefer the King James or the New King James. Now, of course, a person like yourself, or even myself, who are not really a textual scholar, you know, you don't read the Greek probably, and you don't pull out all the different manuscripts and compare them to see which one's most accurate.
No.
You might think, well, what hope do I have of deciding which of these texts is better? And the truth is that, you know, the more you study, the more you can reach some intuitions about this, but it really doesn't matter much because the differences between them are not very great. I mean, there are individual words and phrases left out of a few of the places in the Alexandrian text that are found in the Textus Receptus, and sometimes whole verses. But for the most part, you'll get the same teaching no matter which Bible you read. I mean, the Alexandrian text and the Textus Receptus differ from one another in a matter of words, but not necessarily in a matter of ideas or thoughts. So you could pretty much be equally safe, I would think, regardless whether you're using a translation that used the Alexandrian or a translation that used the Textus Receptus. I don't think it would make much difference. The biggest issue with me in choosing a Bible would be not so much which of these manuscripts they're using, but what is the philosophy of the translators with reference to translating. Because some translators feel they should translate word for word as much as possible. Others feel that word for word translation is somewhat choppy and hard to read, so they want to smooth it out by paraphrasing somewhat and trying to rephrase the thoughts into different wording in order that a modern reader can understand it better. Now, the New American Standard and the English Standard Version and the New King James Version and the King James Version and the Revised Standard Version, some of these versions followed more or less a word-for-word translation philosophy. But a lot of popular versions now do not. The NIV does not. The New Living Translation does not. Hardly any of the new translations really follow a word-for-word translation philosophy. Instead, they like to rephrase things. Of course, the Living Bible, the Phillips Translation, the Message are all examples of Bibles that don't, they just paraphrase it. They don't even care if any of the words in the English correspond with any of the words in the Greek. They just want to get the idea across. So so they read the idea in the Greek. They say, well, I think the idea means this. And then they put it in their own words in English without necessarily trying to go word for word. Now, some people like that. I don't. I would prefer a word for word translation myself.
Yeah,
you've got a New King James. Yeah, you've got a New King James.
I never knew about the different text, so that's some good information to know. Maybe it'd be a good idea to also get another Bible just so I can, sometimes, you know, you read something and you're right,
yes,
you can't really understand it because it sounds choppy and can't really make sense of it. So
yeah, I would recommend using more than one translation. I use the New King James most of the time, but if you wanted to have a good translation in that uses the Alexandrian text, you might choose an ESV, that's English Standard Version, or a New American Standard Version. Pardon?
You said ESV?
ESV, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, if you had an ESV and a New King James, you'd probably get the best of both worlds. You could compare them and see that in some cases the ESV is not going to have as many words or even as many verses as the New King James has. Whether that's an improvement or not is what's debatable. But the ESV is pretty understandable, I think, too, although it's a fairly word-for-word translation.
Well, thank you very much for answering my question. I appreciate it.
All right, Teresa, thanks for calling.
You have a good day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye now. Well, we had another caller waiting, but that caller apparently couldn't wait that long, and so we lost them. And therefore, right now our lines are open, but we don't have very many minutes left, so please give me a call if you'd like to be on the air. The number to call is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. Now, I want our listeners to know that we are a listener-supported ministry, and although all the radio programs you listen to are asking for money, and it makes me want to never mention money on this program at all, and the truth is that it is my inclination never to mention it, I just have to force myself, because the simple fact is that we stay on the air only because we pay for the time on the radio. That is, we pay the radio stations. And it costs us tens of thousands of dollars a month. Many people may not be aware of that. You may notice we don't have commercials. We don't have products for sale. We don't have sponsors. We're just entirely listener-supported. If you donate to this program, not one penny of what you donate will go into my pocket or the pocket of anyone else here at the Narrow Path. All the money that's donated pays for radio time. I'm a volunteer. I don't get paid. Nobody gets paid. This is a labor of love, but we can't put it on the air if we can't pay for the radio time. If you're living in the Denver area or Colorado and listening in Denver, there is a matching gift offer. If you would like to give something toward the support of the program in the Colorado area, if you mention Colorado on your check, there is somebody who will match your gift and double it, and it guarantees it will be able to stay on there. If you're listening on KBRT or KCBC, we definitely will need to get some more support if we're going to stay on the air. If we don't stay on the air, well, that's the Lord's will. We have never really thought that staying on the air is, you know, what holds the world together. But if you feel there's some benefit in the program and you'd like to support it, you may want to write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. You can find that address at our website also, or you can even donate from the website if you want to. The website is thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk next to Frank, calling from Ontario, California. Frank, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Good morning, Steve. My question is, I'm curious about the life of George Mueller, and I've heard mm-hmm. you speak about him quite a bit. Is there a particular biography or author of a biography on him that you would recommend over any other?
Not over any other. Roger Steer, S-T-E-E-R, is one of the biographers of George Mueller that is considered to be one of the authoritative ones. Also, another biographer is A.T. Pearson, who knew him personally. Pearson is P-I-E. R-S-O-N.
Pearson, okay.
His biography is called George Mueller of Bristol. There's also smaller biographies of him. One is written by somebody named Basil Miller, and there's another one written by Faith Cox Bailey, and there's also, of course, George Mueller's own autobiographies, and there are more besides. You know, the truth is, almost any biography of George Mueller is going to be edifying, and you're not likely to find any that are making stuff up. You know, so I mean, this man's life is a good one to become acquainted with.
Yeah, I'd heard you speak about him before, and I had read a little bit about him in another book, but it wasn't specifically about him, and I kind of became a little bit interested in his life and everything. So, great, I really appreciate your time. You have a good day.
All right, Frank, God bless you.
Thank you.
I know. Oops, cut him off. Didn't mean to. Let's talk to Chris from Long Beach, California. Hi, Chris. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
All right. Thanks.
I had a question regarding, I'm not sure on what exact chapter, but it was 1 Corinthians regarding marriage.
And, chapter 7.
It says, for the unbelieving husband is sanctified to the... Mm-hmm. With a believing wife and vice versa. And then it mentions that if it were not
otherwise,
so,
your children would be unclean. Yeah.
Yeah. Would that? What if your parents weren't necessarily Christian, but the child was? Would that apply also, or would it have to come through?
Paul is not saying that children are saved because their parents are saved necessarily. He is saying that the Christian parent in the home, of course, has the influence on the child that may bring them to Christ. And he's speaking about that as a generality, I think, that if he's talking about Christians who are thinking about leaving their non-Christian mates, he's saying, don't do that. Don't divorce your non-Christian mate. And he says, you need to stay there for the sake of peace, that you can try to win your spouse. And he said, also, your presence there, the result of your presence in the home, means that your children are holy. And what he means by that is, I think your children have come to Christ through your influence. And he says, otherwise they'd be unclean. So I don't think he's talking about some kind of mystical trickle-down kind of salvation from the parents to the children just by virtue of having Christian parents. I think it's what it's saying is something what we might all observe just naturally enough. And that is, the presence of a Christian parent in the home is going to tend toward the children being Christian more than if there's no Christian parent in the home. So I don't think he's making an absolute statement or an absolute guarantee that a Christian parent is always going to have, Christian children, or that you have to have a Christian parent in order to be a Christian child. Being a Christian, of course, is a personal decision and a personal commitment that one makes to follow Jesus Christ. And a child can make that commitment even if they don't have Christian parents.
Oh, okay. So what if... What about the husband and the wife in general? What if the wife was more holy and more Christian?
Well, if she's more holy than her husband, then she can hopefully have a good influence upon him. The idea would be, as Paul says it, that the Christian spouse, whether it's the husband or the wife, can have an edifying effect on their unsaved spouse, hopefully winning them to Christ. That's how Paul expresses it there. That discussion is in 1 Corinthians 7, verses 12 through 15. But we're out of time right now. I appreciate the calls very much, and those who listen, and those who support this ministry. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We're on Monday through Friday. This is Friday, so we won't be on again until after the weekend. So have a great weekend. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. God bless you. Thanks for joining us. Talk to you Monday.